Hello, I'm Andrew Fuller, and today we're very fortunate to be with Dr. Karen Spielman, whose area of expertise, well, she has many areas of expertise, but one of those areas of expertise is the treatment of eating disorders in the context of psychological medicine. She has many, many practices, really, across Sydney, Paddington, and Bondi, and who knows where else, but is dealing with quite a lot of people as they deal with the aftermath, well, hopefully the aftermath, a pandemic. So welcome, Karen. It's great to be with you. I'm honored to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's lovely to talk to you. And thank you for the introduction. Paddington and Bondi are the only places I'm at the moment. It feels like more, but I have a general practice in Paddington and I run the general practice part of Headspace Bondi. So they're my hats at the moment. Uh-huh.
Okay, so we've now got you pinned. We know where you are. That's good. That's excellent. Yes. So do you think the pandemic's had an effect on the incidence of eating disorders, Karen?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, Andrew, it absolutely has. And we've been talking about and thinking about it for months. It's been so fascinating to see the impact. Eating disorders are so multifactorial, but I think that the pandemic has pressed a lot of buttons for a lot of people. And so the impact has certainly been a huge increase in presentations, whether they're new presentations in younger people, as well as people of all walks of life who are struggling under pandemic conditions with, particularly with their relationship with food as a manifestation of other anxieties and other mental health issues. I think that the pandemic has increased. I think the numbers bandied about has been an increase of 50%. It certainly feels like that. I don't know if it's just because I'm seeing a lot in my practice here or at Headspace, but some days I feel like I'm dealing with them all day, every day.
Wow, and is that mainly new cases or exacerbation of existing cases?
I think it's both. I don't see new patients very often, but I've been talking to a lot of colleagues who've been getting new presentations, and certainly the intakes at Headspace I think there's been more numbers there as well. And I've had people within my own practice who are presenting for the first time, or kids of families that I've been seeing for a long time.
So while a number of your patients would sort of self-select, I imagine, for other practitioners, I wonder if you have some advice about how do you raise the issue that there might be the presence of an eating disorder when you suspect that there could be one?
I think the first thing to know when you're thinking about it is to be very careful and very sensitive, and be aware that how you raise it is going to make a big impact on the person and or their family or loved ones, because as you know, eating disorders are something that serves a purpose, and that we call ego syntonic, something that works for you. And so if you're coming straight out and saying, oh, I think you've got an eating disorder, we need to fix this, you're going to lose the relationship with the patient straight away. I think that goes for doctors as well as parents and teachers and counselors, that to recognize that it's something that you have to be very careful about when raising. It makes a difference, the language that you use and the way that you do it. I don't mean to frighten you off in terms of whether to raise it, because I think it really is vital to provide a space where people can reflect on their behaviors or feelings that might be impacting on their well-being. But it's important to be sensitive about it, I think. Will you agree?
The framing of this as a treatable issue that is not describing all of you, I would imagine to be a really important part of that. I just wonder if you want to speak to how you try to almost from the very word go create some empowerment or agency among the people that you're seeing that helps them to start to see that there's already a pathway, or they're already on the pathway to some recovery.
Oh, exactly. That's a really a good point, because I often say that to people about a lot of mental health issues, the fact that we could discuss it and raise it, you know, you're halfway to getting better in some ways, because these things often are difficult to raise and difficult for the person themselves to bring it to somebody's attention, and it can be a relief to have the space to raise concerns. So if you're noticing something as a parent or as a doctor or as a teacher, it's some kind of non-threatening comment, I think is a really good way of starting something that you notice, something that might be objective rather than judgmental. Yeah, I noticed that. You asking about healthy eating, or some, like, often a presentation with young people might be becoming interested in being vegetarian or vegan, or interested in losing weight, and you can be a little bit curious rather than judgmental. I'm noticing this, what do you think of that? Or have you ever struggled with your relationship with food? Or is this the first time that you've had these kind of questions?
So talking to somebody about regaining their health or building their energy or their strength, of course, would be important. I guess you must come across the odd person who denies that there is any issue whatsoever. In those instances, what do you tend to do?
I always leave the door open, and I was thinking about that on the way to preparing for talking to you today, Andrew. I was remembering a couple of young people whose parents have called and said, could you see so-and-so because I'm worried they're developing an eating disorder, or I've noticed this, and then I'm left with the young person in my consulting room, and we're having a grand old chat about everything else, and I'm being really sensitive and careful and asking really open-ended questions and leading questions, and everything is met with not worried about this, not worried about that. You have to be careful to say, okay, well, a lot of young people at your age or your stage might be concerned about this, and if you ever do have any worries, please come back and see me, or here's some places to go to get help or to get some more information. Exactly, never say, oh, they're fine and it's not a problem. It's always, why don't we check up again in a couple of weeks, or is it okay if I talk to mom or whoever, and just make sure there's nothing else that they're worried about. It's not an urgent problem often. Obviously it is sometimes, but you have the luxury of time in general practice to develop a relationship and to make sure that people are open to coming back and to having a good experience in the practice or with medical care. And then they can come back a few weeks later, as one of the young people I was just thinking about and said, actually, you remember when I denied vomiting after food, after meals, like mum was worried I was doing well? Actually, I was. And can we talk about it? Just leaving the door open. And that's really important, I think.
So that establishment really of trust and a connection of support is critical really to building a framework for treatment, I think, given particularly the tendency towards rigidity of thinking of some of these people. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And my passion is in making GPs and medical practice accessible for young people, so they don't need to wait to be dragged in or worry about coming back, that it's an accessible process. And we know that starts right from making an appointment and walking into the surgery and how they're treated and what the waiting room's like and how they're billed and how the appointments are made. So making the whole process accessible is really important. And I think for young people and families and teachers to know that there are GPs that will be responsive to these questions, and not to take no for an answer. If you are worried, make sure that you're seeing somebody who is open to a conversation and to getting you back and to following up and creating a safe space.
So eating disorders is a classic example of psychological medicine, the interrelationship between the biological and the psychological, which I know, Karen, is an area of your own interest, as it is mine.
Yes.
I was wondering if you wanted to comment just generally about that, because I think recently it's become an even more fascinating area with research emerging.
Oh, hasn't it? And that's something that my colleagues and I are very passionate about, as I'm sure you are, that people don't differentiate mind and body, and we do experience our mental health in our bodies and our physical health in our minds, and we can't separate it. And I think, like you say, research is bearing that out, that, you know, even in terms of diagnosis and treatment, that we have to be more open-minded to how different things impact, so that there are physical manifestations of mental health and vice versa. And people don't necessarily fall into diagnostic categories really easily either. And it, like you say, disordered eating is such a perfect example of that. There's such a spectrum of behaviours and concerns, isn't there, that you know, very rarely there's a clear line between one thing and the other. And as generalist doctors and mental health practitioners, we need to be very aware of the whole person and the whole mind and how to manage that holistically, whether it's with non-prescription treatments or getting my tongue tied a little bit here. I'm not quite sure if I've answered the question properly.
Well, I guess it's intriguing to think, and I know this goes beyond the sort of diagnostic sort of criteria, but would the different types of eating disorders have a tendency to mirror different types of personal issues or personal types of thinking? Is there a pattern at all that you discern, or is it basically each patient as they come?
There are some patterns, I think. Yeah, I think there are certain, patterns is a good word. I don't like to stereotype things, but there are certainly things that you can look out for that might help. And I guess just a couple of examples, you know, there would be the early female teens with anxiety who start to worry about body image or healthy eating. I would be more worried about restrictive disorders, and the older teenagers, younger adults, maybe with substance abuse issues, you might worry about more bulimic type presentations. And then people who struggle with dieting or with metabolic issues, you might be more worried about binge eating. There are certain patterns that you can be more aware of, but then there's everything in between, and over the years people do change as well, so one thing might morph into another, and of course there are a lot of comorbidities too, so eating disorders often co-present with other issues you need to be aware of.
So correct me if I'm wrong, please, but one of the things I've often said to parents is that if you have a perfectionistic child, don't allow them to control your kitchen, because that can translate into control of food. Do you think that's still accurate, or am I a bit outdated?
I think that's not an unreasonable thing to say. Yeah, and I guess that fits with the stereotype of rules around a more restrictive eating pattern, and that it's really important to be flexible and to live within a family, and so if one person's controlling it sets up unhealthy patterns, so yeah. Not a good one for rules, hard and fast rules either, but yeah, no, I think that's a good point.
Rough indicators, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was working at the hospital, one of the kind of rules of thumb again that I had was when anorexic patients were directly angry, so often as they would improve, they would become better and sometimes more heated in expressing their anger. Where it was a more direct form of their angst rather than diverting it through their bodies.
Absolutely. You know,
does that also hold as a kind of rule of thumb, do you think? Or
100%, and I was having that conversation this morning, in fact twice I think in my session this morning, was how our feelings about food get so fraught, and so I don't mean to say obsessive in a clinical way, but we become obsessed about food and it stops us thinking about other things. So part of when you treat an eating disorder is you're very much uncovering what it is that the function that the eating disorder held. So your example of a young person getting angry at their parents about, to use a stereotype, that would be absolutely classic of, okay, now we've dealt with the food stuff, what's really going on? And that holds by, I think, every eating disorder at every age too. I just had that conversation with an adult who's been suffering with disordered eating for probably 20 or 30 years and has only just started talking to me about the family dynamics. I mean, not that I'm not treating her. She's got another couple of people in the team, but we were just reflecting on, okay, now we know after 20 or 30 years, right, now we're getting to the guts of it. It's interesting how we use language too, isn't it?
The guts of it, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well phrased. Yeah. So what can appear to be worsening is in fact improving, and that's sometimes hard for families to understand too.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the beautiful roles that I would play as a GP is, helping them along the way to see how the treatment's going and to reassure them, well, this is great. It's fabulous that they're getting angry. That means they're getting better. It's terrific. It's supporting the family and carers with how to manage that is really important.
I'm just wondering if you could put on the sort of futuristic lens and think just briefly about into the future, the things that we don't know yet how to do that would be great to know how to do. Are there things in relation to eating disorders that you think would be things that it would just be great to either do research on or to understand more deeply than we do currently?
Oh, yes, there's a long list, Andrew. I'm delighted you asked. I'm involved in the Inside Out Institute as well, and they do brilliant research. And I know there's a lot of things that they're looking at. I think it's awful that only such a small percentage of people with disordered eating get help. So I'm really passionate about trying to work out how to get people into help, whether it's treatment or prevention earlier. I think we need to do better work on what is it that's stopping people getting help. I think we need to get better about actually what works. We don't really know. Is that fair to say that? There are only some parts of treatment that we can be really clear about what works and what doesn't work. And there's so much that we don't know.
Yes, I think that's true. My sense of it is we try and throw almost everything at these patients and their families in a sort of hope something sticks, really.
And that's an effect.
Yes, we do need to differentiate what is more effective.
What are the causes? We know there's so many different causes. I know there's a big study about genetics, and we understand a lot more about family history and genetics, and how important is that? I don't know. I think that's a big question. And if so, how do we manage that? How do we do prevention? I know a lot of people working on health promotion. That would be nice to know what's effective. I think the language thing's really important in the media and in society about avoiding focus on weight loss and unhealthy body image type things.
I can certainly think over the years of a number of twins that I've treated who have both had eating disorders. I don't know of any research, however, that suggests there might be a higher incidence because of genetics in them. But it's an interesting, intriguing idea.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. The honourable work that you do in this space, it's remarkable.
Thank you so much for your time today. I want to honour the work that you do. I think it's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Find more resources for supporting the mental health and well-being of young people on the Generation Next website. While you're there, consider becoming a member of the Online Learning Hub, where you can access practical sessions from leading experts on demand. There are many sessions available in the ever-expanding learning library, and each session has an instantly downloadable certificate of completion, which you may even be able to use to claim professional development. You can also feel great about your membership, with all proceeds supporting Generation Next's not-for-profit initiatives, including this podcast. You may also like to read more in Generation Next's Young Minds books. Both books contain practical and easy-to-read chapters on a range of topics from Australia's leading practitioners. Andrew Fuller's chapter, What is Resilience and How to Do It, is in the book Growing Happy, Healthy Young Minds, available on the Generation Next website at www.generationnext.com.au. We hope you found this podcast helpful. Please share this podcast and your learnings with others. Until next time, thanks for listening and for all you do to support young people and our communities.